Stem Cell Exchanges. Your insight into stem cells from leading scientists.
An embryonic stem cell is essentially gives rise to every cell in the body. So every single one of us was an embryonic stem cell at some point.
I think we all are interested in embryos in the first place, because as soon as you can understand that you start off as a little thing and then you get bigger, then you start to wonder, well, where did you come from in the first place?
Welcome to Exchanges at the Stem Cell Institute with Marianne Alves in collaboration with Pint of Science. The Cambridge Stem Cell Institute is a world-leading center for stem cell research based at the University of Cambridge. Our mission is to transform the prevention, diagnosis, and treatment of disease through a deep understanding of how stem cells work. We have 29 research groups with over 300 scientists spanning basic to translational research. You'll be hearing more from some of them in this podcast series. This week, we are speaking with Professor David Rawich, Head of the Department of Pediatrics and Wellcome Trust Senior Investigator.
I would like to start by asking you, how did you choose pediatrics in the first place, and how did you became interested in research and white matter research?
Okay. All right. I became interested in pediatrics because I have always been fascinated by the way that we can understand the mechanisms of disease and how that can show up in terms of how a human is impacted. And so in pediatrics, it's the place because, you know, we start to take care of patients as soon as they're born, that patients that have genetic disorders will often present to a pediatrician. So it's a case where we know that there's something about the development of that patient that has been affected by a gene mutation that they have. And that's different than diseases of adults where maybe smoking or diet or other factors will cause the disease, what we would call more of an environmental impact. In pediatrics, you tend to see a lot more of the diseases that result from the intrinsic genetic makeup of the patient. And that to me has always been a fascinating issue that relates to my research, because I think we can also take that type of information, that is to say, the mutations that might be causing disease in a pediatric patient, and derive models to be able to study the mechanisms involved. And from those mechanisms, we can devise new therapies, either drugs or even gene therapies, that will be based on sort of a coherent understanding of the cause of disease. Being able to make a model of it, that is something I can talk about, but that's something we do in the lab. And then using all of that information to come up with a treatment that is really almost going to be perfect for that patient, because it really addresses the exact problem that caused their disease. So my interest in research has always revolved around the idea that there are genes that help to program how the brain develops. And if those genes go wrong, you can have devastating problems in brain formation or brain function. And I wanted to use that type of understanding to be able to elaborate new disease treatments, or at least an understanding of disease that is, you know, kind of an advance. So my lab has always focused on the role of genes and how they will turn on particular developmental programs that can, for example, make motor neurons. So one gene that we've studied, if you have a mutation in this gene, there are no motor neurons. That's a very big problem, because it means the animal can't breathe, can't move, and the animal would die right at birth. But it's understanding how that gene works that gives us an insight about how humans that may have motor neuron problems could be affected, and the types of mutations that could be involved. Now, from that understanding of basic genes, you can now start to make models, and you can start to look at how genes that are involved in fundamental development might also be involved in repair after injury. So in terms of my laboratory, we've had a longstanding interest also in genes that will make up the myelinating cells of the central nervous system called oligodendrocytes. And myelin is a particular substance. It's a coating of the nerve axons, and that is essential for the nerve conduction to occur efficiently. So if you have a mutation of a myelin gene, a baby, let's say a human that's born with a mutation of a myelin gene, will have a very terrible quality of life. They will never sit up, crawl, talk, or walk. So one substance, it's just a particular substance, you know, in the brain, even though all the cells are there and all the connections kind of are there, you need to have this insulating substance called myelin for the brain to function, or else the whole thing just really doesn't work. Those kids ultimately will go on to die. So that gives you kind of an example of, I guess, how genes, you know, can really affect function in the long term. So we've studied patients with these severe myelin disorders. We can understand the genes that are involved in their condition. We can also now, in the laboratory, take cells from the patients or make animal models. If we take cells from the patients, we do a procedure called induced pluripotent stem cell production, where we take a little teeny piece of skin, and from that we can create the basis to make an oligodendrocyte. But in this case, it's going to be an oligodendrocyte from the patient that has the mutation, so we can study what goes wrong in that cell. That gives us a couple of avenues towards therapy. One, you can imagine, is we can just fix the gene in that cell. We know the gene that's broken. We can use a technique called gene editing in which we can kind of fix the gene, make it normal again, and then show that the cell is able to function normally. And we can do this all in the laboratory. We can even take those cells and put them into experimental animal models and show that once we transplant the oligodendrocyte that has the fixed gene, it now will be able to myelinate in the host animal. And that would lead to, ultimately, a therapy where we can take a patient's own cells, fix the gene, give the cells back to the patient. And that would be something that I think in the long term we're going to start to see happening in pediatric studies, where as long as we understand the genes that are involved, as long as we understand the cell biology, we have the laboratory techniques to be able to do the gene correction, and we can transplant back safely. I think those therapies will start to emerge for these very severe myelinating disorders.
And the timescales are compatible, since we're talking about newborns that have such a harsh conditions, there would be time available to do all of that procedure.
Well, that's a great question. So we don't know yet, and that would be part of the research, is if you did all of that, how much of a difference can you make? We also need to really understand all of the biology of the process of myelination to be able to have a sense for the feasibility of that approach. Now, myelination is a kind of a late process, so that when a baby is born, they don't have very much myelin. That partly accounts for the fact that a baby's don't do that much. I mean, they eat, they poop, you know, they have a couple of, they cry, you know, they have myelin actually to help them do those things. But when it comes to sitting up, crawling, all of the more complicated motor skills that take time, we think that part of the reason it takes time for them to acquire those skills is they're gaining myelin as they develop. And so myelination, even in a 1.5-year-old kid, is not very, you know, it's not very robust yet. And it continues to happen. In fact, until you're about 20 years old, there continues to be new myelin being produced. So there may be a long window where if we can intervene early, let's say fix the oligodendrocyte, transplant the oligodendrocyte back to a baby, that may give them, in fact, enough time to be able to use the myelin for their further development. That would be the hope, but time will tell, you know, whether that can actually be done. But there's a second avenue, there's a second approach we can take, which would be to now use those models that we've created in the laboratory and look for drugs that can help the cell perform better. So in the particular case of the myelin gene disorders that I've been talking about, the oligodendrocyte with the mutation will develop to a certain point. It happens to be a point in the oligodendrocyte's life that's very stressful. It's the point where it has to decide whether to become a myelin-producing cell or not. And that takes a lot of energy of the cell. With the mutation of this particular gene, what happens is the cell gets to that point where it's just about to make up its mind, and the gene kills it. So the cell dies right at the point when it's transitioning to become a myelinating cell. And there's tremendous amount of stress that's happening in that mutant cell just before cell death. Now, can we find a drug that can rescue that? And so my laboratory started a project several years ago where we now took the patient-derived models. We started to use different drugs to sort of explore if we can support that cell in getting through this really stressful transition point. I think different methods that we can use based on these patient-derived models, which will provide, you know, new approaches to think about therapy. These could be, as I say, we're fixing the cell with gene therapy and giving it back. Or maybe we're finding a drug that just makes the cell work better. And that will be hopefully enough to make the patient's own cells survive the real stresses and be able to continue to function. They may not be 100%, but maybe it'll still be enough to really make the patient much better. And I think this is kind of a general approach that we use in the stem cell biology community, in the Stem Cell Institute in Cambridge. In particular, we have the ability to make the patient-derived models called induced pluripotent stem cells, and that is the basis then for the researchers looking at a bunch of different diseases, you know, heart disease, brain disorders, skin disorders, eye disorders. You know, all of these can be modeled using this basic iPSC platform, which is available to stem cell researchers.
It seems very, very promising. How do you explain to the public that is listening with such good and exciting advances that things still take so long to get to a practical therapy and treatment?
Yeah, I think for cell-based therapies, for the things that people call stem cell therapies, I have to say that the progress has been too slow. And that when we talk about stem cell therapies, the public thinks of, you know, a cell that's going to have a very therapeutic or helpful property once it's been given to a patient. But then the biomedical community becomes much more technical and actually has created a way to think that they're making progress, which really is not as impressive as originally promised. So in the biomedical community, stem cell therapy includes bone marrow transplant, which has been practiced for over 50 years. And many stem cell centers around the world, when they think about the therapeutic application of stem cells, they still are thinking about bone marrow transplant. Now, they may be putting in new genes into the bone marrow, and they may be engineering parts of the immune system to be, you know, working in different ways, but essentially it's the same old thing. And when I look at stem cell programs, if all they're doing is bone marrow transplant therapy, then I don't think they're really doing anything novel, and I don't think they're actually even asking the question of what the promise of stem cell therapy is. So there are other centers, and I think Cambridge is one that is actually unusual in that there are novel cell-based therapies that are being they're in a pipeline for testing in humans. One example would be Roger Barker's study of Parkinson's disease, where he's using dopaminergic or a type of a neuron that's sick in Parkinson's disease is being produced in the laboratory to give back to patients. And these will be cells that will be injected into the brain of Parkinson's patients to see if those cells can help. Now, that's a real cutting-edge stem cell therapy. And I think that is the type of thing that needs to happen more often, where we really answer the question that the public has been interested in, what is the promise of stem cells? But to do that, we have to really show patient impact, and we have to have centers like Cambridge Stem Cell Institute that are willing to really go into the unknown territory of the brain, the heart, you know, the areas that traditionally have not been treated by stem cells like the blood stem cells. Now, in my laboratory also, we have investigated these kinds of approaches for white matter disorders, and I was the head of a clinical study where we injected neural stem cells into the brain of patients that have a rare myelin genetic disorder. What we were primarily looking at in that study was safety and to see whether if we inject neural stem cells into the brain, that they don't cause problems. And We reported our outcomes 1 year after the transplantation, and now we're just putting together our 5-year outcomes after transplantation. And fortunately, we found that the approach and procedure is safe. Now that might sound maybe that doesn't sound too exciting, but I remember 6 years ago, 7 years ago, when we were planning this study, and we were talking about putting neural stem cells, directly injecting them into brain of a boy, you know, or set of boys. Now, what if that formed a tumor? What if that caused a severe inflammatory reaction so that they, you know, so there's the real chance that we could have made them worse. And we were really scared that by doing this, again, it had never been done before. So we had no real idea about what to expect, but we did have certain concerns. And so at the time, we knew that this is an important study to do. If we found that the approach was safe, that would mean you can now start to think about the next phase of studies, like maybe the gene-corrected cells and putting them back in. But let's say it wasn't safe. Let's say we did this study, which is a very basic kind of observational study where we're putting neural stem cells into the brain and then we're seeing if the kids tolerate them okay or does it make them sick. If we found a problem, it really would have stopped the entire field of neural stem cell therapy. So it was an important thing to do because the families were willing to accept the risk and they saw the potential benefit. If the cells were well tolerated, they might have actually helped those kids. It was a case where we did a study that came out with, I think, kind of a very simple outcome. It is safe. And it might not seem that that's very important, but I would say, actually, it's kind of an important, it's a big step. It's going to enable now a whole new set of therapies, including Roger Barker's therapy, to proceed without as much concern as we had 7 years ago when we just didn't know what was going to happen if we put these cells into the brain.
And since we're talking about kids, so 5 years for some people may seem a short amount of time to assess for safety, but because development in children is so fast, 5 years kind of a test for the safety regarding tumors, etc., because it's all very accelerated, then we can be really reassured with the 5 years period.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. I think you know, the other reason to do the 5 years is because we did really want to look carefully at the possibility of a tumor forming. And we thought 1 year might not be enough time, whereas we were confident that in 5 years, if there was going to be a problem like a tumor forming, we should have seen it. So we kind of built in this extra long-term follow-up component of the study. So I think it's going to be a very strong safety study in the end. And it will now open the door for a number of other studies going on. So I think your question was, you know, is the public frustrated with progress? Well, there is progress, but it's kind of taking place in this process-oriented way where we first have to establish safety, then we can start to think about the other, you know, ways that we can make a patient better with an efficacy study. And those are the studies that we'll probably see in the next 5 years. There are cell-based therapies that are being now tested for amyotrophic lateral sclerosis or Lou Gehrig's disease, or, you know, in Cambridge, it's a disease that Stephen Hawking has, and others like spinal cord injury. You know, some of these cell-based therapies are now starting to be used in the brain. And so, you know, we are starting to see how progress is taking place. But it might still seem too slow to the public. And also, I would say, you know, that there are many centers around the world that I think could take more seriously the challenge to be able to show the clinical benefit of cell-based approaches.
What have you learned from these applied research, but you have learned a lot about the basic mechanisms of oligodendrocytes and myelin formation. What would you say? So you already mentioned that there was a specific gene that you said it was very important for the decision of the cells. Is there any other major finding you would highlight that you gain while trying to come with a therapy that you learned about the basic biology of the brain?
I think that's a great question. I think, you know, there are probably many examples in many different labs around the world of where people are just sort of trying to understand a basic mechanism. we're at a point in the field of biology where instead of just looking to a fly or a fish or a mouse for a kind of example of a mutation that affects development, we can really look at humans. We have the ability to sequence the entire genome. We can do that in about 1 week. And so the tools are really now available to be able to systematically almost look at patients that have mutations, be able to look at the mechanisms involved, and then you get a basic biological insight that you might not have known from just studying, you know, the experimental models in animals that scientists typically choose. Whether a drug then helps, that could give you a surprise. So I think, in our particular example of the myelin gene mutation causing this sort of super stress on the cell, that seems to be all triggered by iron. And so iron is it's an element that's part of our diet. It's in, you know, many cells in the body. It's widely accessible to oligodendrocytes. But when they have this mutation, it's toxic to the oligodendrocyte. Now, that also may start to have relevance when we think about the role of iron in normal oligodendrocyte biology, and does it become sort of out of whack in the cells that have the mutation? That's something we can now start to ask, and there's a whole set of questions that will sort of address your question, approaches that will address your question of will this give us new insights into a basic biological process? But even though we're studying this in a kind of mutated oligodendrocyte, it's also possible, and if you start to look around at other conditions of stress on the oligodendrocyte, like in stroke, for example, we think the oligodendrocyte also becomes super sensitive to iron in that situation as well. So it could be that if we develop now drugs that are going to be able to help the oligodendrocyte cope with iron toxicity, now we can start to think about other white matter diseases where there could be a similar stress situation, and maybe these drugs are going to be helpful in other conditions like stroke or other more common sort of white matter disorders.
That's very interesting. Can you briefly explain for the public who is not familiar with these terms, what exactly is white matter?
So the white matter, the brain we divide up into two broad categories called gray matter and white matter. If you looked at a brain that had been taken from an animal or from a patient, it actually does look gray and white. And the white is the electrical connections between neurons that we call axons, coated with the substance myelin, which is white. And so the white matter color comes from all of the myelin that's covering these electrical connections between neurons, which are responsible for communication. So we would say the white matter is the communication highway. That, you know, the neurons are living in different parts of the brain. They need to connect to each other, and they need to connect to the body. And they do that through electrical wires covered with myelin, and that looks white. So now if you have a disorder of the white matter, you have a disorder of communication, and it would be just like, you know, you lost your Wi-Fi. Or, you know, something, you know, or your phone is dead. You know, you can't get the signal out. And that's what happens in the case of multiple sclerosis. You'll have a more transient impact on white matter, where we would see an autoimmune reaction killing oligodendrocytes, resulting in demyelination and ultimately damage to the electrical wires. Now, instead of being able to sit up, you know, that white matter connection is compromised. You can't sit up. You know, you are just temporarily, you have neurological dysfunction. In stroke, which is a lack of blood supply to parts of the brain, that can also affect the white matter. And when it affects the white matter, you get a disorder of communication so that the body cannot, you know, respond. It doesn't really get the signals from the brain. Now, what you'd like to be able to do in both multiple sclerosis and in stroke is try to repair the white matter as quickly as possible so you can restore communication. And that's the sort of way that you might think about therapeutic approaches to white matter injury. Another common cause of white matter injury is seen in little preterm babies, and that can result in a condition called cerebral palsy. And so now we understand that cerebral palsy, which is a disease that's been described for almost 200 years, results from damage to white matter. Again, a problem of communication. The brain can't communicate to the muscles in the body, and now you have problems in movement and sometimes, you know, severe paralysis.
Can you explain, so you've briefly mentioned that the babies with the rare disease that you're studying, leukodystrophy, right?
Yes.
Yeah. They can't sit or crawl. So this is something that will only be diagnosed much later on, right? Can you briefly describe this disease and how you how did you came about to studying this in particular, and why it is important to study rare diseases in comparison to widespread mainstream diseases?
Yeah. Okay. Well, I think you know, this is a disorder which, if you study myelin, this is the most extreme example of a myelin disease. When there's a genetic disorder that really prevents myelin from ever forming, these are the patients that are the most severely affected. Compared to an MS patient, they're 100 times worse. They have no myelin. MS is multiple sclerosis. Those patients, again, will have a kind of a damage to a part of their white matter. In some cases, we hope it gets better. The patient will recover function. They have maybe 30 or 40 year disease course. The patients with the genetic disorder that presents as a baby, they may only live to 5 years or 10 years of age, and they have this totally compromised quality of life without any real ability to do anything for themselves. Even sitting up or standing or walking is a struggle, and that's in the most extreme form. So in a way, if you're a myelin biologist, looking at the most extreme form can teach you sometimes the most dramatic lessons about what's going wrong. Now, from a point of view of a clinician, you'd like to be able to identify those patients as early as possible, because we think that with many genetic disorders, not just myelin disorders, but many genetic disorders that affect the brain, the heart, the liver, you know, almost any organ system that has a severe genetic disorder, the longer it goes unrecognized, the worse the patient gets. And they usually, these genetic disorders cause dysfunction and damage. And so you want to kind of limit the damage component if you can identify them early. So it comes back to now putting on my clinical hat, and my clinical specialty is called neonatology, and that is a baby doctor. So I would take care of preterm babies or sick full-term babies that need to go into intensive care. They, you know, they're the sort of patients that I take care of. And many of these patients, maybe up to a quarter, will have genetic disorders. So it's a kind of a field of medicine where many of the patients that have severe genetic disorders will actually come to a neonatal ICU. Now, that doesn't mean the neonatologist is switched on to be able to diagnose a disorder like a rare myelin disorder. But that's because we don't really employ all the tools that we could do to achieve early detection of these diseases. And so another project that has been started in Cambridge with a collaboration between Cambridge University, the Sanger Institute, and a center called the Biomedical Research Center in Cambridge, which is funded by the National Institute for Health Research, will now bring the genetic tools to the neonatal ICU so that we can rapidly detect a patient that might have a rare genetic disorder. So now we have the capability for the neonatologist to ask for genetic testing to be done from a very small sample of blood. Probably, it's so small it's even hard to describe. It's probably, it's 1 cc, so it's about a fifth of a teaspoon. So a very tiny amount of blood. But that's all that's needed. So we can take that from a baby, and it's not going to be really affecting the baby very much because it's such a small amount. But from that, and working with a company in Cambridge that specializes in high-throughput genome sequencing, We can get a whole genome information on that patient with now information that's going to be helpful to the clinician returning back within 8 to 14 days. So this is a revolution, I would say, compared to the technologies that I had when I was training as a doctor. The idea that you can have all the data from the genome, you know, in about a week. And then we can also get people to start to analyze the data to look for all of the things that the clinician wants to know about and then tell the clinician within the next sort of 3 to 4 days is incredible. What that means now is that we can even start to imagine genome sequencing as being a screening tool that would be used in the neonatal ICU, where there are often very sick patients and you just don't want to waste any time figuring out what the diagnosis is. We can almost start to think of this as a routine test that we will do in the future. But certainly if we have a baby that's presenting with some neurological symptoms that we think might be, you know, indicating a rare neurological disorder, now that the doctors can just send off this test, we can check all the genes that are involved, like myelin genes, how you know, if there are problems, we'll know right away. We can start to tell the family what to expect, which is really helpful for them because often these patients with rare genetic disorders, they go undiagnosed for a month, 6 months, a year, 2 years. Sometimes they're not diagnosed till they're 5 or 10 years old. The family has gone to many doctors. They've had many tests done. They've all turned out negative. They just have no idea what's going on. Where we could have told them that right at the beginning, and I think that will make their lives and their child's life, you know, sort of easier to cope with. We'll know the right specialist for the patient to go to. We'll know the right information to counsel the family. But that's only step one. Now we have this new possibility of a window that we previously couldn't achieve. A window where we've detected the disease early before a lot of secondary damage has occurred. Now, if we have a therapy, let's start it. and that's the potential of this. That's the real exciting potential of this project. Is to now create an early therapeutic window for babies that have rare genetic disorders that now makes them eligible for clinical trials.
And you see that happening in some years, 20, 50 years, who knows, that could start being a routine, not just in Cambridge, but something that could be adopted all over the world.
Yes, I think that we now have neonatal screening that's performed in many countries, and that will detect things like hypothyroidism, which we used to call cretinism. And it's a kind of a relatively common disorder, but you want to be able to give thyroid hormone to those patients to prevent severe mental retardation. So that's an example of neonatal screening. Now with whole genome sequencing, you can imagine in the future, this is what we'll be doing, where we can survey for, you know, thousands of conditions. It's such a tremendous amount of information that it gives you lots of information about things that we don't quite know what they mean. So there's a lot of complexity to all of this idea of using genome sequencing as a neonatal screen. But I think that's where we will be in 20 years. And what Cambridge's role is to get started now, because the expertise here is unique. And the resources in the area are almost unique in the world. Not only do you have the Sanger and the European Bioinformatics Institute and the genetics and population biology of Cambridge University, but you also have the NHS, which is a really uniquely suited system to do long-term outcome research, because the NHS is a single payer system. This is very different than the United States. And so that means that you can actually follow a patient's course. Medical problems that accrue over time are recorded in the NHS system, and those can be accessed. There's the possibility that you can actually attach now educational records, which are also standardized throughout the UK, to look at how, you know, a patient who may have a genetic condition might develop, you know, a learning deficit or attention deficit or some other disorder down the line. You know, we have the means to be able to identify those patients and their long-term outcome electronically, and then figure out who we need to approach to do further studies. You can't do that study in most countries. So the UK is very well organized to do that particular type of work, which means we can now think of taking the genetic information at birth and really coupling that to long-term outcome. That's one example of a project which I think has intrinsic value and will yield a lot of new insights. It can also start to help us understand the impact of the environment and genetics and how that affects long-term outcome.
Do you have any message for the public or any other topic that you want to mention that we haven't mentioned so far?
I think that we would see a lot of progress in biomedicine if families are asking for participation in research studies. We can actually create opportunities for new drug trials in children. Typically, drugs are tested for adult disorders, and these are the big blockbuster drugs. And drug companies are really fixated on the common disorders of adults. And children are systematically neglected. So most drugs have never been tested in children. They're only hand-me-down drugs that are tested in adults and then kind of repurposed for kids. So I think that, there should be a real appetite from families to get involved in clinical trials and to really push the regulatory agencies, to push the drug companies to really think about, applications for children. There are many drugs that could be useful for kids, but, there's no real pressure and there's not really an incentive for drug companies to really think first about applications in children. When we think about these rare genetic disorders, many of them have drugs, but the patients are not eligible to receive the drugs, or the companies just don't want the hassle of making the drugs available because they have to maybe take liability. And so patients that really could benefit are losing out. I think if we take that approach, we're also going to learn things about adult disorders that it's a new avenue to kind of really look at all ages approaches to diseases that may show up in a child, but we haven't really exploited that opportunity to learn as much as we can about the childhood disorder or how we can treat it.
Makes a lot of sense. So thank you so much for this interview. And we end with that note for the families to think about participating more in research. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to this week's Stem Cell Exchange. To hear all our future episodes, subscribe to our podcasts. We will also be having an event in Cambridge in June where we showcase artworks inspired by the research of all the scientists we interview. For more information, go to stemcells.cam.ac.uk. We would like to thank our collaborators, Pint of Science, and the Stem Cell Institute Public Engagement Seed Fund and its funders, the Medical Research Council and Wellcome Trusts, for supporting this podcast. Have a great day.